This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. Every day at Invesco, they bring together ideas with technology, data with inspiration, and investors with solutions. Find out more at Invesco.com/together. Invesco Distributors, Inc. In this week's podcast, Vanguard's Maria Bruno offers some fourth quarter portfolio strategies to prepare retirees for next year's tax season. Travis Miller discusses dividend opportunities in the utilities sector. Eric Jacobson breaks down high-yield municipal bonds. Alec Lucas explores dividend fund options offered by Vanguard. And Sue Romanoff sheds light on Teva's valuation against the backdrop of the politically charged opioid epidemic. Let's get started. First, Vanguard's Maria Bruno offers some fourth quarter portfolio strategies to prepare retirees for next year's tax season.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar. We're in the fourth quarter, and that means it's time for all investors, but especially retirees, to strategize about year-end tax and portfolio planning. Joining me to share some tips for the fourth quarter is Maria Bruno. She's head of U.S. Wealth Planning Research at Vanguard. Maria, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. Always good to be here, Christine.
Let's talk about kind of a to-do list for retirees when they think about their taxes and their portfolio management jobs before year end. So at the top of the list, if you are over 70 and a half, you've got to put those required minimum distributions, right?
Yes, I would agree. That's probably the big one. So most retirees have accumulated wealth in tax-deferred retirement accounts. And beginning at age 70 and a half, you have to start taking distributions from those accounts. So the important thing is you need to take those on a calendar year. So the RMD must be satisfied. If not, the penalty is pretty stiff. It's 50% of the amount you should have taken, and then that's all subject to income taxes as well. In the year you turn 70 and a half, you can certainly defer that until the following year, April 1st of the following year. But you want to be mindful by doing that deferral because then the following year you'd be subjected to two distributions.
Okay, you've got to take another one by year end if you do
Correct.
That.
And okay. That might have, not so good consequences for the next year's tax return.
That could be a really high tax year if you had two.
Yes, it could,
year.
Depending upon how large the balances are, absolutely. So the key there is to make sure that you take the RMD before the end of the year once you begin taking those distributions at 70 and a half.
Okay. So one thing that I think is kind of a neat strategy, and I'd be curious to get your take on it, is this qualified charitable distribution that can be tied in with a required minimum distribution. So not just anyone can take it, but let's talk about how the QCD works and what the benefit is, especially if you were inclined to make charitable contributions of some kind.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of that strategy. So if you are charitably inclined, one thing you can do is a charitable qualified distribution from the IRA, for instance. And what that means is you are actually designating the beneficiary to get the proceeds of the RMD. So you don't, as an account holder, take the RMD, but it's actually payable to the charity. So okay. It bypasses you altogether. What's nice is it fulfills the charitable intent. The amount is $100,000 up to $100,000 once you reach age 70 and a half. And that's per account owner. So if you have a married couple and they both have IRAs, it can be up to $100,000 for each account owner.
But it can be lower if you're
a
smaller
giver. It can be lower,
giver.
Yes. Okay. I guess my point there is that the limits are pretty generous right. If you are charitably inclined. And the nice part about that then is it does not even factor into your adjusted gross income. So you take it off the top. So your income is lower just by that very step. You satisfy the RMD. The charity gets the full amount of the money. And it doesn't factor into your tax picture at all. So things that are triggered from income, whether they be the taxation of Social Security, whether it may be Medicare Part B premiums that are based upon income thresholds, or even your marginal rate in general, those things that are triggered off of income are lowered just by that very that strategy itself.
Okay, so a really neat strategy to consider if you're subject to RMDs. Charitable contributions, it's all changed given the new tax laws and the fact that we have this higher standard deduction. But there are ways that retirees can think about tying in their taxable holdings to make a charitable contribution and potentially get a tax break. What what are some of those strategies?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and the one thing I will add to the QCD as well, if you do that approach, then you can't take a charitable deduction. So essentially, you
on
can't,
that same
on
contribution.
That amount, right? So you can't double dip. It's either one or the other. Okay. But there's benefits to doing that if you're charitably inclined, and you have the proceeds to do that. Otherwise, if you have taxable monies and you want to do gifting, whether it's a charity. Or even if it's giving to family members. If it's a charity, the standard deduction has gone up. So many individuals who used to itemize, they may be taking advantage of the standard deduction. So the benefit of itemizing through charitable deductions may not necessarily be there. That doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't still do that if you're charitably inclined. There may be tax benefits. So, for instance, if you have highly appreciated assets, so many retirees have built wealth in taxable assets, and they're sitting on hefty capital gains. If they were to liquidate those assets and donate cash, they'd be subjected to cap gains taxes on those proceeds. What they could do is donate the highly appreciated assets, and the basis transfers to the transfers out of the individual holder, so the charity gets the full amount, and then you never really have to pay gains on that amount. So it's one way to satisfy charitable intent, but doing it in a very tax-efficient way as opposed to giving cash.
Another strategy that you mentioned, Maria, is that even though you wouldn't get a charitable deduction for doing so, if you wanted to give some funds or some assets to your loved ones, you can also tie in those highly appreciated taxable assets there too, right?
Absolutely. So if you find that you're in a high tax bracket and maybe your kids are in a lower tax bracket, by transferring those assets or gifting those assets over, the basis carries over. And the children can either keep those assets or liquidate them at maybe a lower tax rate as well. So some tax maneuvers there that are worth exploring if that's an option.
Right. Let's talk about tax loss selling. Doesn't seem like 2019, where we're sitting here in kind of mid-October, it's not shaping up as a great year for tax loss selling, but that might be a strategy. Tax gain harvesting is something you're hearing a lot about. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, it's interesting as you think about it. The tax process has changed, right? The federal tax system had changed last year. So how we think about taxes on an annual basis may be different because of the higher standard deduction, particularly for married individuals.
Right. So
whether or not you're itemizing or using a standard deduction, there's strategies you can still use within that. So certainly if you have losses within your account that you may want to look at, particularly if you need to rebalance the portfolio, if you're overweighted in certain areas, well, maybe you could take advantage of some losses. That's not necessarily going to help rebalance your portfolio, but it may help mitigate some of the tax consequences of rebalancing with any gains that would offset that. So, for instance, if you have losses, you can offset the gains. You can offset income up to $300,000. You can also carry those forward. Capital gains harvesting is exactly that. You're selling assets that are at gains. But if you find that you're in a lower tax bracket this year for whatever reason, maybe you are itemizing and you might be able to take advantage of some quote-unquote extra income, cap gains harvesting can be a way to help maybe rebalance the portfolio, better your financial situation in terms of portfolio construction, and maybe using that extra income, those cap gains, maybe if they're offset by something else. So that's the strategy there, and those are really pairing strategies in my opinion.
Okay, so an example would be, say I've got some security in my portfolio that is maybe a larger portion of my portfolio than I really want it to be. Maybe it's company stock or something like that.
Yes, that's a good example.
Mm-hmm. I am in a temporarily lower tax bracket. The idea is get that out the door at the time you're in a lower tax bracket so the tax burden associated with the selling isn't as great
as
it
would be. So you might find, for instance, that, hey, well, maybe you might take a qualified charitable distribution. Maybe your income's a little lower this year. Okay, maybe I'll accelerate a little bit of cap gains or some income here to help offset that and presumably be in a better tax situation when I do liquidate those assets. So that's the tactic there.
Okay. So throughout, it seems like a recurrent theme is I'm thinking about not just what's good for me from a tax standpoint, but what's good for me from a portfolio standpoint. And with some of these tax moves, I'm trying to correct some of these issues. Is that a good way to think about it?
Yeah, and I would actually think about the portfolio first, right?
Okay.
So how am I from a portfolio standpoint? And then how do I either maintain that or correct that in a tax-efficient way? You never really want the tax to drive the investment decisions. But if you're making investment decisions or putting money into the portfolio or taking them out, think about how you do those moves to better the investment consequences of that.
Okay. So final point is you think it's a good time of year to kind of look at maintenance of various items. You mentioned beneficiary designations before we got rolling. I think that's a good one for people to check up on. What else?
Yeah, we kind of get lazy, right? So we set these things up and we may not necessarily check them over the years. But I would say first, you know, take a look at the asset allocation. Make sure your goals haven't changed and that your risk tolerance, your time horizon, all those remain intact. If so, then your asset allocation should be okay. The key there, as we know, is that will help you if things get a little rocky in either the economy or the markets or things like that. And then from there, look at things like insurance. Are you adequately covered? Do you have the right beneficiaries? Do you have, you know, look at the portfolio. Do you have a lot of overlap, for instance, or money at different institutions? You may benefit by consolidating to make the administrivia a little bit easier.
Right.
So those are types of things that aren't necessarily fun, but they're necessary. And then sometimes when you go through them, you feel better because, like, yep, we're good. Or you might find you want to make a few changes here or there.
And you're probably, if you're looking at some of these other tax issues, you're touching some of that data already. So you might
as well do it while you're in there.
You
know, some of these can get a little tricky. So, you know, maybe you want to talk to an accountant or an advisor who can help number crunch some of these things with you. The key is to do that, you know, now, not necessarily on 12/31, because your options may be a little bit more limited, but certainly use the fall season to take a look at these options and then make the right decisions and then implement them before the end of the year.
Okay, Maria, always love to get your perspective. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.
Now, Travis Miller discusses dividend opportunities in the utilities sector.
Utilities are a sector that investors often turn toward for yield, but we also think that investors should be cognizant of valuations. Right now on the yield front, when you look at 10-year U.S. Treasuries below 2% and the U.S. dividend yield for utilities above 3%, utilities look like an attractive yield option. However, valuations are extremely rich. Price-to-earnings multiples, price-to-book multiples are all well above 3-year decade averages. Even we think the sector is well overvalued. Although it started the year at fairly valued, we think utilities are now 13% overvalued given the run that they've had in 2019. That said, we do think there are some good yield opportunities. The industry has very good balance sheet strength, fair payout ratios, and a lot of good growth. A couple of the names we like are those yielding above 4%, such as CenterPoint, Duke Energy, Edison International, and Dominion Energy. We think these utilities are well positioned to grow earnings and dividends based on the infrastructure investment needs across the U.S.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Next, Eric Jacobson breaks down high-yield municipal bonds.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. Investors have been barreling into the high-yield municipal bond category so far in 2019. Joining me to discuss what investors need to know about the category is Morningstar senior analyst Eric Jacobson. Eric, thank you so much for being here. It's good to have you here in person.
Hi, Christine. It's great to be with you.
Let's talk about the tax advantages of munis generally before we get into this high-yield subset. Why have investors been especially attracted to munis of late?
So as you know, some of the tax law changes have made it even harder for people to take advantage of deductions and so forth. And so people are just in search of a way to gain income without having it be taxed or disallowed and what have you. So that always is something that will make municipal bonds that have tax advantages more appealing to people.
Okay, so municipal bonds are typically free of federal income tax, and they may be free of state and local income tax depending on what muni you invest in.
Right. You know, depending on how you look at the geography, a lot of the high tax states are really in such a way that investors in those states really can use and have demand for municipals even more than they already did. Because as you know, if you have states where they don't tax the interest from their own bonds, that's
right.
a big deal. And if you live in New York City, for example, things like that where you can get triple tax exempt.
Okay. And this state and local tax cap, this SALT tax cap, makes it even more attractive for people residing in those states to try to get some tax-free income.
Exactly.
So let's get into this subset of high-yield municipal bonds. I want to talk about flows into the category, but first, what are we talking about? Is it analogous to the taxable high-yield bond category in that these are kind of junky credits that have higher yields?
So it's interesting. It's a little bit of a misnomer.
Okay.
It's an important distinction, but it's not a homogenous kind of category. So for example, in taxable high yield, you can look at that universe and you can see a pretty clear circle around the companies and the kinds of bonds that you will find in that universe. They are generally below investment grade, meaning they have ratings that are either double B or lower. And most of the names in that space have ratings, okay? And they're the usual suspects in terms of industries, often a lot of capital intensive things, but often things that have a lot of buyout activity and generating a lot of income. But you know, whatever the universe is, and it is kind of broad, it's a known pretty specific universe. It's not huge
okay.
in terms of the breadth.
Right.
It's a big market, but anyway. So
that's the taxable.
The taxable side. Mm-hmm. On the muni side, though, it's very, very fragmented. Now, the muni market itself is very fragmented. But once you get into the muni high yield space that we might think of, there's not a good, clear technical wall. Like, as I said before, in taxable high yield, it's below investment grade.
Right.
In municipal high yield, and this is a little bit debatable on the part of certain people, but generally speaking, in the municipal world, most people think of triple B as being part of the high yield muni universe. So even though triple B is technically investment grade, if you look at outside ratings, those bonds tend to be favored by high yield muni funds. They tend to get lumped together with them. You know, you'll hear arguments that their default occurrence is a lot lower than corporate triple B, for example, and there's some truth to that in terms mm-hmm. of the default history. But if you're looking at the universe that high yield muni funds are involved in, it starts there. And the other issue is that there are a lot of smaller non-rated issues.
Okay.
And they do cluster in certain sectors, including for nursing homes, for example. But they're really tiny often, and they don't have a third-party rating because it's usually not economical for them to pay for the rating.
Okay.
So there's just a lot. It's a very heterogeneous universe
okay.
in that regard.
So those non-rated credits may not necessarily be junky. It's just maybe not efficacious or economical for them, as you say, to pay for the rating.
Right. And that's absolutely true. And I'm not calling any fund manager a liar when I say this. But sometimes it doesn't matter. And what I mean by that is, yes, the ultimate default experience can be low in the sense of you can have these issuers that are not going to default, but the bond may be very small and it may not be widely held. And what that means is if we're in a financial crisis of some kind, even if it's a little mini crisis, a bad quarter, a bad half year, what have you, bonds like that could still become very illiquid. And when that happens and people are selling and the pricing agencies mark prices down, it really doesn't matter
right.
whether the quality is that high. And I'm mentioning that mainly because if you own a fund that owns lots and lots of non-rateds, not only do you not know for sure just because the manager says it's high quality, but it may not matter that much just in terms of day-to-day pricing.
Okay, and we saw that on display during the financial crisis, right? Munis as a group had some liquidity issues, and my guess is that non-rated subset, the higher yielding non-rateds, also had some liquidity problems?
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's get into what you've been seeing in terms of flows. It's pretty interesting. They had been pretty tempered until this year when we saw the big spike. Do you think it is, as we discussed at the outset, that this tax law change has prompted some investors to really gravitate to munis in general, or what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, I don't think anybody knows for sure, but
yeah.
I definitely think that's a very plausible reason. A lot of times there's more than one driver behind that, but that would seem to be a pretty likely situation given the recency of the tax law change and now it's started to hit people and so forth. I mean, there's always going to be some demand for high yield munis among people that are looking for extra income, especially in the kinds of environments we've had in the last several years with interest rates so low. So I would suggest that, you know, anytime you have a marginal change, like tax law change or what have you, that's probably going to spike it also.
Okay. So assuming I'm looking at this category, and it appears that a lot of investors are, what should I know beyond some of the things that we've already discussed? I guess a key question for me would be, can I look at this as sort of core muni exposure, or is it something that I would maybe bolt on once I've got my core high quality muni exposure?
I would absolutely advocate not using it as a core,
okay,
but rather as a bolt-on, and I would be very, very careful. And the reason I say that is I really want to distinguish between what this is and what a high yield taxable fund is like. You know, the sectors are different. This thing about the non-rated stakes is different. You know, we haven't had a recent catastrophe of any kind, but over the arc of time, we've been through periods where individual funds have gotten in a lot of trouble for one reason or another. You really have to have a manager that you believe in and trust and so forth. And regardless of the case, I would be really careful looking at how much of the fund is not rated. If you see a high-yield muni fund that advertises itself as that and you can't tell how much is in non-rated, I would either call and ask the fund company or don't mess with the fund, because that's a really important piece of information. And it's hard to suss out sometimes. And basically what it gets down to is the more non-rated exposure you have in a fund, the more important that the rest of the fund is to be very, very liquid. And the bigger a risk it is just in general, if some exogenous factor causes, I don't want to call it a run per se, but a wave of outflows, certainly for the sector as a whole, but absolutely for your specific fund or fund complex, that could become an issue and it could drive prices down.
Okay. And how helpful is yield in this context? Should I, in addition to maybe doing some of the due diligence at the portfolio level, is yield, you know, I'm looking at a fund and it has a much higher yield than the peer group, is that a red flag that there's something cooking in that portfolio that might introduce risks at a later date?
Absolutely. I like to tell people there's no truer indicator. Now, what I mean by that is I'm not going to tell you that the highest yielding fund in every category is automatically a red flag. I would always want to dig in and understand why that number is the way it is. Sometimes it's time period shifting and, you know, there are quirks that can cause these things. But by and large, you know, you can look at ratings, you can look at names, all those things are sort of second level stuff. When you see the yield on a fund or the yield on a portfolio, that's an indicator of how much the market thinks there is risk embedded in it. In other words, when the market sees risk, it drives the price down, it drives the yield up. The highest yielding fund in any group is almost always, by definition, almost always going to be the most aggressive. Now, you may see one, and if you really like it, you want to understand why it's doing what it's doing, but definitely understand if it's at the higher end of its category, it's doing something to get there. And sometimes it may just be liquidity risk. It may not be absolute credit risk. It may be liquidity risk, it could be maturity, it could be taking a lot more duration, a lot longer maturities and so forth. But you really want to make sure you understand or are comfortable with what those factors are before jumping in.
Okay, Eric, always great to get your perspective. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Christine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
Every day at Invesco, they bring together ideas with technology, data with inspiration, and investors with solutions. Find out more at Invesco.com/together. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Now, Alec Lucas explores dividend fund options offered by Vanguard.
Investors have long loved dividend-paying stocks. As John Burr Williams said in the 1930s, a stock is worth only what you get out of it, and investors get a lot out of dividends. While dividends aren't contractual payments, companies are loath to cut them, and some prioritize growing them. That's made dividends a reliable source of return. Broadly speaking, dividend equity strategies come in two distinct flavors, and the Vanguard Group has one of each, in active as well as passive varieties. The first flavor is a high dividend yield strategy, which focuses on companies that pay above average and sustainable dividends. Vanguard High Dividend Yield ETF is the passive option of this flavor. It charges 6 basis points per year, or $6 for every 10,000 invested, and tracks the FTSE High Dividend Yield Index, which is a market cap weighted benchmark composed of the highest yielding US stocks, excluding real estate investment trusts, or REITs. The active version of this flavor is Vanguard Equity Income. Its investor shares charge 27 basis points per year. Michael Reckmeyer of Subadvisor Wellington Management oversees about 2/3 of the fund's asset base, and Vanguard's in-house quantitative equity group runs the remaining third. As of September 2019, Vanguard High Dividend Yield ETF, the passive option, had a higher trailing 12-month yield than Vanguard Equity Income, the active option. But Vanguard Equity Income had a higher total return after fees over the past 10 years. It outperformed thanks to holding up better than the index in down markets, including 3 of 4 corrections. The second dividend equity strategy flavor is dividend growth. Dividend growth strategies don't focus on above-average dividend payers, but rather on companies that have been increasing their dividend at a faster clip than the rest of the market and have a good shot of continuing to do so. Vanguard Dividend Appreciation ETF is the passive option of this flavor. It charges 6 basis points per year and tracks the NASDAQ U.S. Dividend Achievers Select Index, a market cap weighted benchmark which holds companies that have raised their dividend for at least 10 consecutive years and also passed additional screens for profitability and earnings stability. That makes this NASDAQ benchmark heavier in consumer staples and industrial companies than the broader market and lighter in energy. The NASDAQ benchmark has consistently held up better than the broader market in downturns. On the other hand, the active version of this flavor, Vanguard Dividend Growth, led by Wellington Management's Donald Kilbride, has had even better downside protection. It now charges 22 basis points per year, and while its portfolio as of September 2019 had a lower yield than the NASDAQ U.S. Dividend Achiever Select Index, it had a higher total return over the past 10 years. Vanguard Dividend Growth has beaten the NASDAQ benchmark and its passive counterpart in each major downturn since Kilbride started managing in 2006. That includes one severe bear market, the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis, and 4 subsequent corrections. In the end, whether investors are seeking income through above average yields or dividend growth, Vanguard has excellent low-cost options for them, both active and passive.
Expand your investing horizons and look to the long term with Morningstar's new podcast, The Long View. Join hosts Christine Benz and Jeff Patek as they talk to influential leaders in investing, advice, and personal finance. Search for and subscribe to The Long View today. And lastly, Sue Romanoff sheds light on Teva's valuation against the backdrop of the politically charged opioid epidemic.
Within the backdrop of the politically charged opioid epidemic, individuals, cities, counties, and states have come forth to accuse drug manufacturers, distributors, and pharmacies of aggressively marketing or failing to report suspicious opioid drug use. This complex matter is more than a decade old and has escalated to over 2,000 cases in the federal court system that is now being referred to as a special legal procedure referred to as the multi-district litigation. This is similar to the landmark asbestos MDL in 1991 involving over 100,000 cases. A major complication in reaching a global settlement to the opioid MDL covering over 2,000 cases and tens of thousands of plaintiffs has been the strong interests and personalities involved. Also complicating matters is the outlier Purdue settlement, which resulted in a bankruptcy. Track one of the highly anticipated landmark federal court case settled at the 11th hour, where the 3 major distributors and Teva agreed to a cash settlement with Cuyahoga and Summit counties in Ohio for $260 million in cash. These 2 counties are said to have been hurt most by the opioid epidemic, and the settlements will likely be considered bellwether and influence future settlements. Teva shares have come down sharply and have declined nearly 70% from the 52-week high with the rise of the opioid litigation, as the company is highly levered and has been negatively impacted by generic deflation. With the progression toward a global settlement, traction on its innovative drugs, stabilization of generic pricing, coupled with cost-saving initiatives, we believe the going concern issue to be overblown and view Teva shares as undervalued.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. We hope you've enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@Morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening.